Lots of us can name key legal cases that ended up before the Supreme Court and what they changed. Brown versus Board of Education, school segregation. Roe versus Wade, abortion. Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission, campaign spending. The changes produced by those cases did not happen overnight. We get other examples of just how much work it takes, a lot of it outside the courtroom, in David Cole's book, Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. David Cole is a leading civil liberties lawyer and professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University. His shorter works have appeared in the usual suspects, Atlantic, New Yorker, Washington Post, and more. His longer works include the books No Equal Justice and Enemy Aliens, which won the American Book Award. David Cole, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So three major areas that you take a look at in Engines of Liberty: marriage equality, gun rights, and human rights in the war on terror. Whew, any light topics?
Well, you know, my goal here was to sort of ask, how does constitutional law change? You know, we focus on the court and the decisions it issues and the dissents that the majority's decisions trigger. Sometimes the arguments that are made before the court by the lawyers. But my sense was that that's really a very partial part of the story, and that to understand how constitutional law in America works and how it changes and how we can change it, you need to look behind the court's decisions. And so I took what I think are really the three biggest success stories in terms of people seeking to change constitutional law and practice in the last 30 or 40 years and examined what it actually took to make those changes.
I noticed you picked from across the political spectrum, and I imagine that was deliberate.
Yeah, I mean, the point of the book is that constitutional law changes not because five justices in robes sitting in Washington, D.C. impose their personal predilections on the rest of us, which is how dissenters characterize decisions they don't like, but rather because we, the people, through organized activity, through civil society, through nonprofit organizations committed to particular constitutional visions, have engaged in a process of democratic deliberation over a period of years and often decades that makes it possible for constitutional law to change. So the Supreme Court doesn't so much change constitutional law, I argue, as recognize that it has changed. But we are the drivers of that change, not the court.
That's a great distinction you make, though. It's not activist judges so much as activists convincing judges.
That's right, and it's us. And in a way, this is a book about the democratic roots of constitutional law. You know, people often question, well, you know, why do these judges who are unelected, who sit for life, have the power to impose their views on us? We're a democracy, aren't we? But I think what this book shows is that actually, whenever constitutional law changes in a significant way, if you look behind that change, what you will see is that it wasn't judges imposing their views on us. It was us working through a kind of evolution in our values through democratic processes.
You clearly feel that the rights groups that push to get these things into the court in the first place are often overlooked. So who overlooks them and why?
Well, I think we all overlook them to a degree. I think we focus on the end game. We focus on the court issuing its decision. But again, the point of this book is the courts that's the end of the novel. And in order to understand how we got there, you have to start with the beginning, and you have to look at the process, you know, by which people transformed things. So, you know, so I'm asking in this book, how did marriage equality go from unthinkable, which is what it was 25 years ago, to inevitable, which is what it was when the Supreme Court was hearing arguments last summer in the case? And how did the right to bear arms, the individual right to bear arms, which was dismissed as a fraud by Chief Justice Warren Berger, a conservative Republican-appointed justice, in 1991. He said it was one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on the American people in his lifetime, the notion that the Second Amendment protected an individual right to bear arms. He took the view, as did 100 years of judicial precedent, that the Second Amendment only protected the rights of states to have militias, but not the rights of individual private citizens to own guns. How did 17 years later the Supreme Court recognized that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms? How did that happen? And what caused President Bush in the war on terror to feel the need to curtail most of his rights-abusing counterterrorism initiatives, given the history of presidents in wartime essentially being given a free hand to deal with the enemy as they deem necessary and fit? And I suggest in each instance it was the result of a extended campaign of civil society groups, gay rights groups, gun rights groups, human rights groups, in a variety of forums, most of them outside of the federal courts altogether, that shifted the ground so that these shifts in constitutional law and practice became possible.
We'll come back and talk about all the switches that had to be flipped and the knobs that had to be turned and the people who had to be activated to get all this to work on these three areas. We're talking marriage equality, gun rights, and human rights during the war on terror as examples of engines of liberty, which is the name of David Cole's book. David Cole's our guest. We'll come back and talk more with him. You're welcome to join the conversation. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with David Cole and you in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is law professor David Cole, a leading civil liberties lawyer, the author of a book called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. He shows us exactly how citizen activists did make new constitutional law in marriage equality, in gun rights, and in human rights in the war on terror in his book. You can join our conversation on the exchange, share stories, ask questions, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Really interesting phrase in here, David, and I'm truncating, just taking a little bit out of it, in which you say the Constitution is designed to limit not just government, but the people themselves. What does that mean?
Well, so the idea of the Constitution is that, you know, democracy is a pretty good system for organizing our polity, but it's not perfect. Democracy does some things well, and it does other things not very well. In particular, it doesn't protect minorities very well. It especially does not protect the rights of those accused of crimes very well. And it doesn't protect the rights of those who express unpopular views very well. And so we have a constitution that is designed to be above the ordinary politics of the day and to constrain the ability of majorities to impose their will on unpopular minorities. And so in that sense, the Constitution is designed to constrain not just the government, but us.
A real great story here that you tell right at the beginning is about Evan Wolfson at Harvard Law, who decided to write a research paper. And what did he choose to do, and what was the response?
So this was 1983. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but he was a third-year law student at Harvard. And he was gay, and he was interested in gay rights. And he thought, well, I'm going to write a paper on the constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And he went around to each of the constitutional law professors at Harvard, and there are many, and said, would you supervise me in this independent research paper? And every one of them said no, because they thought it was so far-fetched, so fanciful. He finally was able to convince a trusts and estates professor to supervise this, even though it wasn't within his area of expertise. He wrote a 141-page paper He got a B-plus on it. But he didn't stop there. He then went out and became a lawyer for Lambda Legal Defense, one of the leading gay rights organizations in the country. He was one of the first within the gay rights community to push for the idea of fighting for recognition of same-sex marriage, which was a controversial idea even within the gay rights community in the 80s. He was involved in one of the first cases that made some headway in this direction, a Hawaii state law case. And then in 2002, he left and created a freestanding organization called Freedom to Marry, which was devoted solely to recognizing a constitutional right to marriage. And one of the things that's interesting about that organization, which grew to a multi-million-dollar-a-year organization, is it didn't file a single lawsuit. Its work was all the work in education and messaging and political organizing that was necessary to create the ground swell, essentially, to create the groundswell in favor of marriage equality, so that when the Supreme Court actually took up this question in 2015, the result was, as I said earlier, inevitable.
You mentioned Hawaii being one of the first places where there was a court case on this. So what happened there? What were some of the results in the early cases?
Yeah, so Hawaii was a case. It was brought by a gay couple that wanted to get married and were denied. And they went to the gay rights groups and said, we want to sue to challenge the constitutionality of the state denying us this right. And the gay rights groups all said no. They all declined. They said it's too early to sue. But they nonetheless found a private lawyer who was willing to pursue their case. And lo and behold, in the Hawaii Supreme Court, they almost won. I mean, what the court said was denying marriage to men because they're two men is a form of sex discrimination, and it required, because if they were a man and a woman, they would be allowed to marry, and it's only because of the gender of the partner that they're not allowed to marry. And therefore, the Hawaii Supreme Court said the state has to give a good, strong reason for denying this right. And that went back down to the lower courts for a trial on that very issue, at which point Evan Wolfson got involved in the case. But that decision was ultimately overturned by the Hawaii people through a Hawaii referendum campaign, just as later California voters overturned a California Supreme Court decision along the same lines. And it also sparked a nationwide kind of backlash in which local states suddenly saw the need to amend their own constitutions to make clear that marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman. And even Congress got into the act, and in 1996 passed the Defense of Marriage Act, which denied benefits under over 1,000 federal statutes to any married couples who happened to be of the same sex, even though at that time there were no married couples who happened to be of the same sex.
David Cole's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. So certainly with gay marriage, it seemed like for every attempt to gain further rights through the courts, there was a very strong legislative backlash. And we had a lot of states at different times, including Oregon and California, both with one man, one woman marriage rules.
Right. And that was a real challenge. And I think what it shows is that you can't rely solely on the courts. You have to have a political strategy, a messaging strategy, as well as a litigation strategy. So one of the things that the gay rights groups did when they actually sort of moved beyond Hawaii and started to engage in a real sort of conscious strategic campaign to achieve this right was to say, okay, we're going to act incrementally. We're not going to go for marriage all in one go. We're going to seek first to amend family law so that it recognizes, for example, the right of gay or lesbian couples to adopt their partner's children and the like. Or we're going to push for domestic partnership benefits, first from progressive companies and universities and nonprofits, and then from progressive municipalities, and then even from states. And we're going to ask for limited domestic partnership benefits initially, but then we're going to expand those benefits to, you know, they ultimately got to the point in California where the domestic partnership benefits were equal to what a married couple's benefits would be from employment. And then they also sought non-discrimination ordinances at the local level and hate crimes laws that recognized discrimination against gays and lesbians as being problematic. And only then did they seek to sue for marriage. And they started in a very progressive state of Vermont, a state where it's hard to amend the Constitution, and they won. They won. They didn't win it all, but they won civil unions there. And then they had to fight against a constitutional amendment within the state, but they succeeded in doing so. And then they went to Massachusetts, where they actually won the first state Supreme Court decision holding that marriage is, in fact, required. And then they took that victory and extended it to Connecticut and to Iowa and to California. And then they went to legislatures and got legislatures in New York and D.C. and various other states to enact through the legislative body a recognition of same-sex marriage. And it was only after they'd made all that progress that they felt comfortable with this issue sort of jumping the tracks and going into federal court. And eventually they prevailed. And, you know, in 1972, a gay couple went to the Supreme Court and said, we have a right to marry. The Supreme Court denied their petition with one sentence saying, doesn't even raise a substantial federal question. We're not even going to address the merits of it. Dismissed, you know, summarily. Mm-hmm. 2015, the court recognizes the right of gay marriage. The Supreme Court in 2015 was, if anything, more conservative than the Supreme Court of 1972. It wasn't that the justices became more progressive. And the arguments were the same. The arguments made in 72 and the arguments made in 2015 were the same. What changed was the ground, the background against which those arguments were seen. A world in which gay and lesbians were free to come out, had come out in large measure, and virtually everybody knew gay or lesbian people, and they had to confront the fact that this is these are our relatives, these are our work colleagues, these are our friends, and they can't be demonized as the other. And it was all of that work that really gay rights organizations orchestrated that made it possible for the court to recognize marriage equality in 2015.
As I look at the analysis, though, it seems like there was a change in the gay community itself, certainly between 1972 and the decision handed down last year, because I think, as you point out in the book, the idea of marriage and therefore assimilation in broader culture was anathema to a lot of the people who were out in 1972, for example.
Right. Well, so there was a debate. You know, there was definitely a debate within the gay community about whether this was something that should be sought for or not. And some people did take the position that no, we don't want to assimilate into the culture of marriage, which has patriarchal problems and is sort of about compulsory heterosexuality and the like. We should define our own relationships. We shouldn't try to fit into this set of relationships. But then there were people like Evan Wolfson who said, no, actually, whether the state recognizes our marriages is fundamental to our dignity and our cause of equal rights, because it is a sin to deny our right to marry is to deny the very thing that defines us, our love for each other. And I think, you know, initially that was a significant debate. Once some of these victories were gained, and once people saw the kind of backlash of opposition that they triggered, many people sort of came to recognize the importance of this fight and jumped into the fight by volunteering. Hundreds of thousands of people volunteered on these issues in ballot initiatives across the country, jumped into the fight by joining organizations like Lambda and Freedom to Marry and the ACLU and GLAAD and other organizations that fought for it, supported it financially. And again, it was the power of those citizens acting together that ultimately changed our country into a country in which this was a completely unthinkable notion into one in which it is a constitutional right.
Marriage equality, gun rights, and human rights and the war on terror are the three examples of ways in which constitutional law has been changed by citizen activists in the country. So recounted in the book Engines of Liberty by our guest David Cole. You can join our discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Gretchen and Ashland. Welcome to the exchange.
Yeah, hi. I thought you said there was a fourth topic, which was campaign finance, and I wanted to know how that shift by the Supreme Court falls in the same theme of from grassroots up citizens actually helping that happen. Is that the truth that your research showed?
Well, I mentioned it in intro, but go ahead, David.
Yeah, no, great question. I don't discuss the campaign finance reform issue in this book, although I have a piece in the this month's Atlantic magazine that applies the lessons learned from these campaigns to the current Citizens, you might even say Citizens United campaign to overturn Citizens United, which is to say that there, you know, yes, what pushed the court to overturn past precedent and free up corporations and wealthy people to spend unlimited amounts of money in political campaigns was a citizens' campaign of corporations, which are made up of citizens, and those who thought that their interests would be furthered by freeing up vast amounts of money. But there's now a very significant citizens' campaign in the other direction, getting public financing reforms enacted at the local level, at the state level, in a number of cities and states across the nation, getting transparency and clean election laws adopted at the local levels. There is work being done by academics, supported by these organizations, to call into question some of the premises of the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case. And I think that's one that is very likely to be overturned or at least significantly weakened over time by this coordinated citizen action. You know, when they take polls about Citizens United, something like 80% of Americans think it was wrongly decided, and something like 70% of Republicans think it was wrongly decided. And the court, sort of studies of Supreme Court decisions have shown that the court rarely departs significantly from where the country as a whole is on fundamental issues in its constitutional law. I think it has, in this instance, departed. But I think if citizens work together in the opposite direction, I think there's a very good chance that they will succeed in cutting back on it and essentially freeing up legislatures to restrict the distorting effects of large amounts of money in political campaigns. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope so.
Which, David, do you think is the more vulnerable doctrine, money as speech or corporations as people?
You know, I actually think neither one of those is the way it's going to happen. If
really?
It happens, I think it's more that that what the court said in Citizens United was, yes, corporations, you know, have First Amendment rights. They'd said that before. Yes, money is speech, or that is restrictions on money in campaigns is similar to restrictions on speech. They'd said that before. But the thing that they said, which really was the problem, was the only legitimate interest the legislature has in restricting spending in campaigns is to avoid bribes and the appearance of bribes, and not the broader distorting effects of influence peddling, which is what these vast amounts of money do. And most instances, it's not, you know, the Koch brothers aren't saying, here, take my $989 million and then vote for my law. They say, here, take my $989 million, and then, you know, they have incredible access to the candidate who wins with their support, and he or she is much more likely to take care to do their bidding rather than the bidding of those of us who don't have those kinds of resources. But the court in Citizens United said those kinds of concerns are not legitimate concerns. Well, they are legitimate concerns, and I think the sort of devolution of our democracy in the wake of this kind of massive spending illustrates that they are core concerns, and you could easily write a kind of jurisprudence of the First Amendment that would recognize that there are First Amendment concerns when the government restricts spending in political campaigns, but also recognizes that there are very important interests in ensuring that ordinary people have a voice in the process and that the very wealthy and corporations can't drown us out.
We're about a minute away from a break here, but I want to ask about how people who say they don't want government to get too big and intrusive, say on gun rights, would want to limit marriages.
Well, I think people on gun rights have a variety of views on marriages. There are many people who are gun rights supporters are essentially libertarians, and they're perfectly happy with the right to marriage equality as well. There are others who are social conservatives and are uncomfortable on the marriage equality issue.
All right.
So it differs.
Okay. Much more to talk about with David Cole. His book is Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. The three major areas he deals with in the book are marriage equality, we've talked about a lot, gun rights, we'll talk about coming up, and human rights in the war on terror. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back with David Cole, Engines of Liberty, and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the civil liberties lawyer and law professor David Cole, currently teaching at Georgetown University and continuing to crank out the books. His latest is called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law, where he shows the many, many steps it takes just to get a case to the Supreme Court and a lot of other things that you have to do just to get the Supreme Court's attention in the first place. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Let's take a call from Rika in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, good morning, Jeff.
Hi.
I started my No More Drug War protest in 2003 because I saw that gays were in the process of gaining their rights to marriage by activism.
And so that inspired you?
Yes. And I said I'd be out there for 10 years if it took 10 years to do the job. And it's exactly what it took before Colorado and Washington legalized marijuana.
And then Oregon did too. So you feel like you had an effect ultimately through long-term activism?
Yeah, me and a lot of other people. It started a long time before I started my protest with the medical marijuana in Oregon.
All right. Thanks for sharing the story, Rika. Appreciate that. So, David, this seems like a valid way in which people have exercised citizen rights as activists and have made an impression upon people in positions to do something about making legal changes.
Well, absolutely. And, this is a point that's true of virtually all political change, right? The way that policies change in a democracy is by people speaking up, gathering together, organizing, and focusing their attention on a problem area to try to fix it, to try to shift it. The point of this book is that we tend to think of the Constitution as sort of being above all of that. It's not subject to a vote by the Oregon legislature. It takes an interpretation by the Supreme Court. But my argument is, in fact, our Constitution has democratic roots and changes in democratic ways through this kind of activism. And yes, it takes time. It should take time, right? We wouldn't want the Constitution to be able to be changeable on a dime, because the whole idea of a Constitution is to inscribe certain principles and rights above the ordinary political process. But we also wouldn't want a Constitution that is stuck in time that doesn't change from when it was, you know, initially adopted 240 years ago by a bunch of white men who didn't represent us and are long dead. We want a constitution that reflects our values. So it has to change over time. And the point of this book is that we're part of that, that we, through democratic engagement in association with those groups that share our constitutional commitments, can and have changed constitutional law to reflect our own visions.
You go on a bit of a riff in the book about Antonin Scalia. I know it was written before he died, but you clearly disagree with his belief that the Constitution is simply what it says, and you do think it needs to be relevant to what we need it to be at this time in history?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's lots of problems with Scalia's approach. One is, of course, how do you determine what the framers thought about, you know, such questions as should the Fourth Amendment apply to the application of a GPS to the bottom of a car to track it 24/7, which is a case the Supreme Court had a couple of years ago. I mean, you just can't answer that question from an originalist perspective. But more fundamentally, you know, why should we be bound today by some document simply because a bunch of white propertied men who didn't even reflect the majority of the community at the time agreed to it? The only reason we should be bound by it is because it reflects our fundamental commitments, and it reflects our fundamental commitments because it has evolved over time. So, you know, it didn't originally recognize the equality of blacks and women, but today it does. It didn't originally reflect a robust freedom of expression. Today it does. It didn't originally reflect the rights of black and white people to marry, and much less people of the same sex to marry. Today it does. But that's a good, not a bad.
Another phone call here from Sig in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Cole.
Yes, I'm specifically concerned about the Second Amendment to the Constitution. I've noticed that it's the only amendment that has within it its own reason for existence, and it mentions about security and then reason and need for a militia. And yet, all of that's dismissed because supposedly people said that we want guns, and the Supreme Court finally endorsed that. But the reality is that the movement for people to own individual guns came not from the people themselves, but from the gun manufacturers. After the Civil War and their sales dropped way off, they made a concerted effort, and that's well documented, to convince people that guns ought to be part of the landscape of our culture. And they've done a great job, and the NRA exists because of that, and there are a lot of people on board with that, but it goes completely against what the Constitution says. And I don't see how the Supreme Court could endorse that.
Okay, you just brought up the whole second part of the book there. Thanks for that, Sig.
Yeah.
And so, David, let's go to his specific charge, though, that it's gun manufacturers working through the NRA. Is that a fair charge?
So, I looked at that. I examined that question. I concluded not really. You know, the NRA, see, people often say the NRA is the gun maker's lobby. You know, certainly gun manufacturers and gun owners have similar interests. But the NRA's annual budget is made up of primarily, about 90% of it, from donations from their members. They have 5 million members. There's between 5 and 12% of its annual budget each year comes from gun manufacturers. Some of that is in donations, but the bulk of that is actually in buying ads in the NRA's magazines, which, of course, are the perfect place you'd want to put an ad if you're a gun manufacturer. But even so, you know, you're talking about 10, 12, 5%. This is a people's organization. It's not a gun manufacturer's organization. They're one of the largest, I think they are the single largest civil liberties organization in the country. And they're focused on one liberty, and they're very focused on that liberty. And their power has been recognizing the critical importance of democratic engagement to the protection of constitutional rights. So they haven't relied on the Supreme Court to protect the Second Amendment. They've gone out and protected the Second Amendment, and they do it through the political process. They grade every candidate for elected office in the country, state or federal, on their commitment to gun rights, and they endorse those who have better gun rights records, and their members vote on the basis of those endorsements. They worked at the state level to change state constitutions to protect an individual right to bear arms so that by the time this issue got to the Supreme Court in 2008, most of the states had already recognized an individual right to bear arms. And so it wasn't that big a deal for the Supreme Court to recognize one at the federal level. They changed the Justice Department's view on this question. They changed Congress's view on this question by persistent political engagement, democratic deliberation. And so, you know, whether you agree with their view of the Second Amendment or not, I think we all have something to learn by their by studying how they were successful and why they were successful. And that's really the focus of that part of my book.
Yeah, there really is a blueprint here that that should be recognized, if not followed. As you point out, though, and this is a history that I know Jill Lepore had written about in The New Yorker in the last year, there was quite a revolution within the NRA itself post-1968. What happened there?
So, yeah, so the NRA was founded in after the Civil War by Union generals concerned that their soldiers were terrible shots. And they really wanted, you know, marksmanship training. And that's really what it was, marksmanship training, hunting, gun safety organization for its first 100 and some years. 1968, Congress passes the Gun Control Act, first major piece of federal gun legislation. And that sparked a response from the NRA. That suddenly the NRA, members of the NRA said, wait a minute, we've got to get engaged politically to protect our rights. They saw a threat. They organized, they created a political lobbying organization in 1975. In 1977, the membership kind of revolted at the annual convention and put in place a leadership which was committed to fighting for an individual right to bear arms. And that's really when they began their concerted effort, like the gay rights groups, at the state level first, before they went, into the federal courts to establish this notion of an individual right to bear arms.
So with the Heller case, which was the one the Supreme Court decided, is the well-regulated militia part of the Second Amendment, the one that Sig referenced, is that effectively benched for the time being?
Well, it's not really benched. I mean, I think what the court said was, look, yeah, there were essentially two interests in protecting the right to bear arms. This is what the NRA folks would say. One was indeed ensuring that states could have militias to fight back against federal tyranny. That was clearly a concern. But a second concern, not inconsistent with that concern, was a right that individual citizens would have guns to use in their self-defense. And many state constitutions, for example, specifically protect the right of an individual to bear arms to protect himself, his family, etc. And that's really the position they took. So it wasn't that it doesn't protect the states, but it also protects individuals. And for 100 years, the court had rejected that view, but in 2008, the court accepted that view.
You mentioned just a little bit ago about how we don't want the Constitution to change on a dime, which makes a lot of sense. Now, the one situation in which things can change suddenly, though, is when we go to war, which brings up the whole third part of the book about terrorism and Guantanamo and rights. What is often the situation with presidential power when there is a situation of war?
Basically, it's unchecked, and particularly unchecked when you're dealing with the enemy. And, you know, the best example, the sort of paradigmatic example, is FDR in World War II interning 120,000 people simply because they were Japanese Americans or Japanese immigrants, and not because there was any evidence that they were, posed any kind of a threat to us. And the Supreme Court upheld that in World War II, so we can't question the president's power in wartime. But what I show in the book is that after 9/11, President Bush sort of assumed that was going to be the way it was for him as well, and put in place things like Guantanamo, torture, disappearances into secret prisons run by the CIA, extraordinary renditions where we abducted people and sent them to countries like Egypt and Morocco to torture them for us. But what he didn't reckon with was the power of civil rights and human rights groups to organize and rely on human rights principles and organizing tactics to create pressure on the president to rein in those measures. And they did. And they got the court to rule against the president. Remarkable shift. And I think part of that was explicable by the fact that after the Supreme Court upheld FDR's internment policy in World War II, civil society groups didn't just accept that. They fought. Japanese American groups and ACLU groups fought to change the our sort of the historical judgment of that period. And in the 1980s, President Reagan signed a law that formally apologized for the internment, paid the survivors $20,000 each, and recognized that it was a terrible, terrible mistake. And that recognition, I think, then played into the Supreme Court not making the same mistake again. And in fact, Fred Korematsu, the person whose case went to the Supreme Court in World War II, filed an amicus brief in the Guantanamo cases saying to the Supreme Court, don't make the same mistake here that the court made in my case way back when. And I think the court didn't. And by the time Bush left office, he had released 500 people from Guantanamo, suspended the CIA's secret prison, suspended the CIA's torture interrogation program, stopped extraordinary rendition to other countries for torture. And as I show in the book, that, you know, that wasn't because President Bush had a change of heart. That was because he felt that he had to do that to respond to the kinds of criticisms and pressures that civil society generated against these practices.
So I guess the ultimate takeaway from the book is that if you want to affect change in society, be prepared for a very long task and collecting friends in groups of twos and threes, it sounds like.
Well, and more positively, that, you know, that the Constitution lives in us. I quote Judge Learned Hand, who said, "The spirit of liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. As long as it lies there, it needs no court, no Constitution to save it." My point is that the Constitution depends on our democratic engagement.
Which is well laid out in the book. It's called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. David Cole wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Take care.